I just want you both to know I'm sending you the light when it lands. Well, at least she's sending us the light. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I am your host, Dan Benamore. Today, we're talking about the 2014 film, The Skeleton Twins. The film stars Bill Hader, Kristen Wiig, Luke Wilson, Ty Burrell, and Boyd Holbrook. Craig Johnson directed the film. Craig co-wrote the script with Mark Heyman, who is one of the writers of Black Swan. The film grossed $5.8 million on a budget of $1 million, according to the internet, and holds an 87% on Rotten Tomatoes. Before we get started, just know we are going to spoil the film. This is your spoiler alert. My guests today are three of the producers of this film, Jennifer Lee, Stephanie Langhoff, and Jared Goldman. Some quick highlight credits. You all are very accomplished. We could go on for an hour with your credits, but just quickly, Stephanie also produced Safety Not Guaranteed. Jennifer also edited this film and has additionally served as an editor on Rami, as well as many other films. And Jared recently produced Palmer and The Devil All the Time. Welcome, Jared, Stephanie, and Jennifer. So you didn't want to jump on each other for the audio. I appreciate that. So up top, I want to just do a quick 2 minutes on how tough it is to get this sort of movie made. So I used to be a development executive and I was at a small company. And a lot of times we would get sent scripts by the agencies that were packaged already with a lot of great actors. And I'd be like, why are they sending us this like incredible package to my small company? And inevitably it would be a script kind of like this, like a dramedy. With that, you know, these are movies are difficult to make because usually they don't sell very well overseas. You have to get the actors to do them for like scale. I mean, there's a whole kind of math challenge of making these movies. Jared, can you talk about how hard it is to make this sort of movie?
It's very hard. I remember I was the last person to come on board. I remember meeting Jenny and Craig at the donut plant on 23rd Street just being very candid when they told me what the budget number was. I had already spoken to Steph. I think we had spoken a bunch.
Yeah.
But I was just very candid. I was like, I have no idea how to make this movie but for this amount of money. But if we are all in it together, then I'm sure we can figure it out. If Bill and Kristen want to make it, then we have to go figure out how to make it. You know, what that meant is like you have PAs driving trucks. It means you have a very small crew. It means you are reusing locations for many sets. And it's just everybody has to, it's just a real, we had a wonderful sort of familial and positive vibe in making this, even though. And it was challenging because like we started filming, we had a window. It was like between Thanksgiving and Christmas to somehow like wedge the whole movie into getting shot.
Wow.
But on the front end of it, we had Hurricane Sandy, which like lopped off like a week or two of pre-production because we couldn't get to the production office or like, so it was challenging, but we were all in an office that was like 1,000 square feet on top of each other. But it was so fun.
So I'm going to jump into the plot. So basically we meet Milo, played by Bill Hader. He writes a suicide note. Right away, the tone of the movie is established because he can't figure out who to address the suicide note to. So he writes to whom it may concern. Then he cuts his wrists. Meanwhile, we have his twin sister, Maggie, played by Kristen Wiig. She's in her bathroom. She's going to swallow a handful of pills, but she's interrupted by a call from the hospital telling her that Milo has attempted suicide. And I want to just talk, I mean, I just want to jump into Bill Hader right away because at the time, you know, that you had made this movie, I think everyone just knew Bill from SNL. And I think if I'm not mistaken, it's one of the earliest straight, you know, pretty straight dramatic roles for Bill. And now looking at him now, right, after making Barry, and I've listened to probably a half dozen interviews with him on different podcasts, his skill at like mimicry and sketch comedy is probably the least of his skills. And he is like one of the best people in the world at that. Like he's a guy who, you know, there's a real world where Bill is going to go on to become like almost like a Martin Scorsese and make a bunch of movies. And like, he's really like a deep dude and there's a lot to him. And I think the general public just did not know that. Stephanie, I would love to know in making this film, what surprised you about Bill Hader?
I mean, he was a joy to work with. He, you know, Craig, I mean, Jenny can speak to how Bill got on board. But he was, since I came onto the project, he was you know, involved with it. And it was a really, you know, it was a big opportunity for him in that it was his first leading role. And he was so excited. And I mean, bless his heart, he was working 6 days a week and crazy out. I mean, his seventh day was just, I'm sure, just like pure survivalism, because he was 3 days with SNL and 3 days with us for two of the weeks. And then we had him fully the other 2 weeks. And I remember our first day of shooting, we were shooting in that bar in Brooklyn, and it was his scenes with, he had a scene with Ty Burrell, and then he had the scenes. I mean, that, like, as Jared was saying, we use the same bar for different scenes. And, you know, I remember after one of his first takes, he came over to us and he was like, "So what did you think? Was it too much, too little?" I was like, "It was perfect. Like, it was just great." And he just really stepped into that role as leading man, I know, just seamlessly and beautifully and gracefully. And he was so funny and yet so deep. And he was just so much fun to work with. He was always regaling us with fascinating stories, whether they be about his time at SNL or his time working at the, you know, video shop in, you know, Oklahoma, where he's from. I think he's from Oklahoma. And he's a huge cinephile, like you were saying. He could be a Martin Scorsese. I mean, he knows so much about film and has such a passion for it. So, you know, and just even rewatching the movie, you know, this week, I'm just amazed at what a beautiful job he did. You know, obviously he had done a lot of other stuff, but in terms of this type of role, he really, you know, you wouldn't have thought that it was his first time doing this kind of role. He did a great job.
Yeah. So Maggie visits Milo in the hospital in Los Angeles. Again, such a specific tone. The doctor gives her the suicide note, and all that he added to it was "see you later" and a smiley face. We find out that they are estranged. They haven't seen each other in 10 years. Maggie suggests he come stay with her in their childhood hometown. He reluctantly agrees, meets Maggie's husband, played by Luke Wilson. His name is Lance. He's the nicest guy ever. Milo describes him as a Labrador retriever. Milo is surprised to learn that Lance and Maggie are trying to have a baby, as Maggie had never expressed a desire for children. We later find out she's taking birth control pills secretly. Milo reacquaints himself with the town, reconnects with his former high school English teacher, Rich, played by Ty Burrell, who is now a middle-aged man working in a bookstore. Maggie is taking scuba lessons and having sex with her instructor, Boyd Holbrook, Billy. And even before the sex, they do buddy breathing, which watching during the age of COVID feels obscene. And then, you know, the affair is such a choice, right? Because the easy way out in, I think, the overwhelming majority of stories like this would be that Luke Wilson's character is a jerk, and therefore the affair is somehow more morally okay, right, for the audience. But that's not what this is at all. Jennifer, can you talk about how the script keeps making surprising choices, and then for you editing the movie, how you have to kind of manage that in the edit, the tone?
Well, you know, there's that trope, right, that the film is written three times, right? And it's written once in the script, and then it's written during production, and it's written during post. And I was so excited when I, after having worked with Craig and with Mark on, you know, developing the script for a few years, to finally, I moved and I found like an old script draft where I had written a note. You know, it had originally started when we met Maggie, she was doing scuba. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit, the scene where she's actually holding her breath and underwater and she gets pulled out. It was like that sort of part of it, and you're not quite exactly sure. And I'd scrawled on the script, like, she should just be killing herself, like, here, like, it should be super definitive. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, when I finally got into the edit, I just remember being so excited, like, now I could finally do it. Like, now it's time. We're gonna show it that way. And like, just to really establish the sort of twin dynamic of them right away. That was really important. And it was, you know, it used to be in old drafts of the script, she didn't try to kill herself until like later and at the end. And it was really important that she do it up front, not just to establish that weirdness between her and her brother, but also so that every time you saw her depressed, you had this weight on you and you were like, is something going to happen now? Like, she's really depressed, you know, to just add that, because we know something that nobody else in the film knows as the audience, right? We know that she's secretly done that. And even in the way the film plays out, like, there's never a scene where she says, "I tried to kill myself," to him, right? There's a scene in the dentist's office, right? Jared's Uncle Kenny, right? That's what we shot at Jared's Uncle Kenny's office. And our dental consultant, and where he's like, I told you a secret and you have to tell me a secret now. And then we're sort of slowly pushing in and you're wondering if she's going to say it. And then she unearths these other secrets. And now we already know that she has been sleeping with her scuba instructor. And then you find out about, like, well, and then there was this, like, other, the nature of photography, you know, and then there's also this, and then I did this other, the salsa dance or whatever, you know, you just, and you already know that she just has this, like, string of hobbies and classes, and you just think that's, like, her thing to stay busy. And you're like, oh my God, she's, like, fucking all these guys, you know, and, like, and these layers of, like, she's so much more damaged. Not to say that that's, you know, that somebody who's doing that is necessarily damaged, but it's just because we've already set her up from the very beginning with the expectation of this is a woman who's deeply unhappy, who is suffering, yeah. Right? You're seeing everything in the color, it was sort of colored by that. And so so that was a lot of it. And I think a lot of it was also, it was the, when do you reveal the information? And that's something that you just sort of have to figure out, you know, obviously in the script, but also in the edit, mm-hmm. But also the tone, right? Like, how do we manage those shifts of tone? And for the longest time, I feel like we were something like, it's a dark comedy. And I remember the first time Mark Duplass, our EP, watch it. He's like, guys, this is a drama. Like, we're calling this a drama. We're just going to call this a drama from now on. And, you know, and then there's all having to deal with, like, the expectations of what do people think it is. Mm. And you have that based on, like, what you call it, you know, and that dealing with the expectations of what people, you know, you're dealing with that from the way you're packaging it, from the way you're trying to sell it, from the trailer, you know, all these different things. So all constantly turning people's expectations as the story unfolds in the edit is something we paid a lot of attention to. And just in the tone, like, how do you go from laughing to tears?
Yeah.
How do you go from tears to laughing without it just feeling like really kind of jerky and, like, disjointed? How do you make that so that those two, what, comedy and, right, what's the saying about comedy is tragedy plus time, yeah. Like, or how do you manage that dovetailing, like, in the real time of, like, whatever 90 minutes or however, yeah, long it is. So that was really the challenge of it.
I think, kind of taking from what Jenny just said, something that I learned from this movie in the process was that when you read the script, it did read, like Jenny was saying, it read like a dramedy. I mean, there would be, you'd be laughing out loud on one page, and then the next page someone will be trying to kill themselves. And it worked when you're reading it because you're recovering quickly. But when you're actually seeing someone do that, you're, as a viewer, you're not prepared, and you're seeing, yeah, the pain, you're like really taking that in, and you're seeing it on their faces and, like, the possible finality of that. You're not ready, you know, 15 seconds later to, you know, receive a joke. It's just, it didn't work. So what happened was, from the script, it did read as a dramedy, probably equal parts comedy and drama. And we realized that we had to pull back on some of the comedy because it just wasn't landing when you were, you know, taking it in as a viewer. I mean, I still, it's still so funny. I mean, there's still so many things, like, I was like, laugh out loud, like, even the note, you know, two, and then you don't see the rest of the note until Maggie sees it, see you later. I mean, it's just, it's so funny. But we did, I mean, that was something I learned in the process for sure.
Yeah,
I take other projects and advise friends who have dramedies with really dark elements to them to be aware of as they're shooting, to know that, like, when you get into the edit room, you're not going to, these jokes may not work in the same way.
Yeah, I think a great example of that is the next kind of scene in the plot where their mom makes a surprise visit, and we find out that she missed Maggie's wedding for an insight retreat. And then she mentions casually that she got rid of her alpacas because they pooped too much, which is a funny detail, but it's also, like, a great metaphor for, like, what kind of mom she probably was, because you kind of get the sense that she sort of got rid of her kids the same way she got rid of the alpacas. They were too much of a hassle. And so there's, like, real drama stuff that comes out of that scene. But then it's like Kristen is playing it so dramatic and Bill is playing it so dry. So it is funny and sad at the same time. And then we find out that, so Maggie asks Milo, if he thinks that she would make a good mother, and he replies that she would be overprotective and uptight, which upsets her. Later, he apologizes, and he said that his main concern was about her morbid obesity. And, then they get high on oxygen in the dentist office. And there's so much, I mean, that there's a little bit there, I forget the names exactly, but it, they're doing almost like an improv game from the dentist chair and her standing above him. She's like, Eddie Kay, really? And, like, you could see them so alive with each other in the moment. Jared, can you talk about their relationship in real life bleeding into the movie? Because it's, I think it's one of the most credible brother-sister movies like ever. Like I was actually trying to think like other brother-sister movies. And I think this is probably one of the best ones.
Sure. I mean, that day specifically when we were shooting in Uncle Kenny's office, they, Kristen and Bill, like snuck into one of the rooms in the office and started doing these improv games, which was really one of the highlights of my career to just witness and just watching them warm each other up and make each other crack up. And then I don't know how long they were doing it for. Maybe they were doing it for half an hour or 40, but at some point it just seemed like they were actually just, it went from it being an exercise to prepare for the scene to just them having fun. They were just having so much enjoyment and entertainment of just making the other one laugh. And so there was a lot of that throughout the filming, and it was very clear they have such an incredible bond and rapport and repartee that, I mean, even, wasn't it like, didn't we film like Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now lip sync in the morning, and then like the heavily dramatic scene where they are outside of the house and they're set in the afternoon, and just because they have like so much trust with each other, they were able to just pivot from something that was like so comedic into something that was so heavily dramatic. I think it would be very hard for other actors to do it. I mean, they just have what they would have been working together for, what, 5 or 7 or 10 years or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of improv too, right? It's just, we're just got to just kind of flow.
Yes, partner. And.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, that scene when they were outside with the fight where he says, you know, I forget what he says, and her response is, well, maybe you should have cut deeper or something like that. And I mean, it's obviously a really intense scene and so sad and so real that, like, if you really want to go for the jugular with your sibling, you would, I mean, you can say something like that and you know what would really get them. And obviously they both are really torn up about it afterwards. But as friends, I remember they do think of each other as siblings. And so to say, they were really both just so, at the end of that shoot day, like they were just really sad and depressed and like, I'm sorry, I said that to you. Like, oh, like they really took it to heart as if it was really each of them saying that to the other. And so it was actually painful to watch because it didn't feel just like Maggie and Milo. It felt like Bill and Kristen is like, pseudo siblings. Anyway, it was really, I think that's why that scene works. I mean, the whole movie.
And now that, particularly well, because now that you say that, I remember after we filmed that, like, didn't Bill, I think it was Bill, like, just like, I need a few minutes, and had to like walk off set. Yeah. And just, he feels, and I think he went up to Kristen. He was like, I didn't mean it. Or she said to him, like, I didn't really mean it. Like, and it was so like poignant.
It was heartbreaking and sweet all at once. It was special.
Yeah. And you feel it. You feel it in the scene and the way it plays out. And that scene when, I mean, it's those lines are scripted, right? Maybe I should try fucking my problems away. Maybe next time you should cut deeper. But like when the way they deliver it, it's like people gasp. I remember like in the screenings, like you would hear people go, like, cause it's just that, like, it's that line you can't take back. And I remember for many drafts of the script, they didn't nail that line. You know, it was like, it was always like the note that we'd give them would be like, Mark and, you know, Craig, like, this line is not nasty enough. It's like, it needs to be even worse. It needs to be that line you can't take back, right? You know?
Yeah.
It has to really cross that line. Yeah.
So,
well, I know we went dark, but to go back to Uncle Kenny's office, was the, Jenny, I can't remember, Steph or Jenny, do you remember like the comment about like, when they're talking about the their friends in high school who both have like the same
Eric T and Eric S.
Yeah. Was that scripted or did they riff that? I can't.
No, it was scripted. I remembered it because I had an S, Stephanie S and Stephanie L in grammar school. And this girl would call my house and be like, is Stephanie L there? And my mom would say, there's Stephanie S does not live here. So I remember that.
Some of their other bits, I think, like when they were doing the goofing around when they were high, like the thing where they speak backwards, like the tape running backwards, like that's the thing they would do when they were like punchy on the SNL set, like just like waiting for lighting or whatever. So they definitely dug into that.
I mean, I do wish we had like the outtakes from that scene when they were high with the phone call bit that they did. Oh. That was also so funny.
Was it a vacuum cleaner? They were like a dustbuster or an iron or something.
It was whatever was in my uncle's office. So they were taking like all this medical equipment and using it as telephones and
like prank calling people. Anyway, it was funny.
I might be on the Blu-ray. I feel like I seem to remember like outputting that.
Oh, maybe so.
It might be on the Blu-ray. Yeah.
So I'm gonna just jump ahead in the plot to keep us on time. So basically, Maggie confesses to Milo that she's been taking these birth control pills to avoid having a child with Lance. And because she's been having sex with the instructors from all the different classes, she worries that she's not worthy of Lance, but Milo reassures her. Milo spends more time with Rich. We find out they had a sexual relationship when Milo was 15. They spend the night together. Later, Milo shows up at Rich's house while his son is there, which infuriates Rich. Milo gets drunk, throws away this little trinket. It's like a Moby Dick thing that Rich had given him in high school.
Oh, Jared!
There it is.
Oh, it
for the audience who is listening to this audio, Jared has this thing like right next to him and just showed it.
Aww.
I just wanted to like a minute and a half on just Ty Burrell, because I mean, we have got to keep the show on time, but I am obsessed with the idea, because Ty Burrell, for anyone who saw Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, he plays like the meanest, just virulent guy in that. And then you watch him on Modern Family and he's like, this is the sweetest, goofiest dude. And I just think this is such a cool role for him. And I wish we could just all get together and cast Ty Burrell in another 16 movies where he gets to play these morally problematic characters. Stephanie, what was the process of casting Ty in this movie?
I think it was almost what you're talking about is, you know, what would be a surprise to audiences. And he, you know, this was 2012 that we shot the movie. And so yeah. I think when did Modern Family was only out a few years, I think, at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the timing worked out perfectly where he had, I think he was only with us for like 2 or 3 days. So, I mean, Craig, we were all fans of his, and Craig met with him and, you know, they hit it off, and I think everyone was happy to see him, and, you know, it was not a typecasting role. And he is, in fact, the nicest person in the world. Like, when you meet him in real life, he is just, he couldn't be more wonderful. So he not only plays that character in Modern Family, I think he is really that lovely. But I mean, I think that Craig liked the idea of having someone who was not what you expected as the teacher. You know, you don't expect a teacher to prey on his student, and a closeted teacher at that. So I think that just as it was a surprise for someone to see Ty, you know, performing against his, you know, character that we know him for in real life, you don't expect your teacher, you know, no one expected that teacher to do that, and, you know, a closeted teacher at that. So I think it worked out really well, and I thought he did a wonderful job in the film.
Yeah, he's excellent in the movie. Okay, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsor. We're going to be right back and get into my favorite part of the movie. That's when we come back. Be right back. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed. You get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. The pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There have also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So Maggie is upset that she keeps cheating on her husband. Milo comes over. He understands that she's upset. and he goads her into the impromptu sing-along of Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now. It's the best scene in the movie. It's the most powerful evocation of Bill and Kristen's relationship. And it's just pure joy. I mean, it's just so joyful. You know, I don't know how to explain it for the audience, for anyone who's seen this movie. Like, it's something where you watch that scene and you so strongly feel their connection. And I think with two different actors, you know, maybe with a different director, maybe with different editing, like there's a million versions of that scene that could be cheesy or sort of like you're trying too hard. And it's not that at all. It's so satisfying when it turns and he convinces her. Maybe Jennifer, you can start, and I'd love to hear from all of you, like just tell me about doing that scene, what it was like in production and maybe in post and all that kind of stuff.
I can speak from the editing side of it, which is that you nailed it in that there's a turn in it, and that's where it really drives it, right? We know what's just happened. He walks in, she's in a terrible mood, and he can see right away. She does that scream into the pillow where she goes, right? And she's like, it's so great. And she's snapping at him, and he knows to some degree it's not about him, although obviously he like flaked off on work and, you know, and he does this thing to, you know, and you know it's this routine that they perfected through their entire childhood, right? You know, like, because it's also this kind of dated, cheesy song or Mannequin, you know, back in the day. And so you just can intuit that it's something they did when they were kids. And obviously she always sang the Grace Slick part, but she didn't want to do it because she wasn't in the mood. And it's just the fact that he kind of woos her into it. And that song is also just like it's just a feel good song. It's like it really lifts your mood, right? And so there was the chemistry of just the song, right? And the vibe of the song that we were contending with. But really it's when I feel like in editing, like whenever a scene is really working or if a scene is really broken, it's not just about that scene. It's about everything that came up to that scene, right? That scene by itself, sometimes you see it like go viral every few months, like it goes viral on Twitter again and people are like, remember, this scene is the most amazing thing. I just want to bring this back on the timeline. And it is so satisfying in part because it's every moment that's come up to that moment. And you know, the fact that they are capable of getting under each other's skin the way nobody else can as siblings, but also lifting each other up and bringing them out of their bad moods. And that's something that like only he could have done in that moment. Like she was so in a self-hating place. And the fact that he could do that is why it's like really kind of emotional. And then, you know, like Lance walking in and with his like kind of goofy, it's just so pleasing and fun, right? And then the way Craig shot it with like the We Are the World, like, you know, holding the ear button, you know, for the saving the push-ins for the end, you know. So it was just a great combination, I think, of the planning of it, but also the writing of it and the dramatic positioning of it in the script, you know?
Well, it was very stressful, though, to get there, because when we were, I remember when I came on, wasn't it scripted as Wilson Phillips, but Bridesmaids had just come out, and we're like, okay, I've got to find another song, but that conversation of got to find another song, you know, you sort of push into the future until you really need it, and so we were, and so suddenly it was like, what's the song, and we were scouting, and we were scouting for restaurants, or maybe we were at a lunch break. We were up in Nyack, and there was a jukebox, and Craig just like was like, all right, I'm gonna put this song on and I wanna know what everybody thinks. And he auditioned a bunch of songs for us, and that was one of them. And we were all like, this is great. And I could see the relief wash over his face. And then on a personal note, so when I have a 7-year-old, so who was born in February of 2014. And when my wife went into labor, she had to go have a C-section. And when they moved her into the operating room, it's like 5:58 in the morning, the surgeon's like, put on some music. And they put on some classic rock station. And what's on? Nothing's gonna stop us now. I turned to my wife, who's in hour 30 of labor.
Oh my God.
Jenny, listen to what's playing. And she's like, can you fuck off for a second? I'm a little bit busy at the moment. So
I do remember when Craig came back and was like, this is the song we want to use. And we're like, how much does it cost? And
then,
you know, the dread of every indie film producer, like how much is everything going to cost? And, you know, Randy Poster was our music supervisor and did a wonderful job. And, you know, I feel like a lot of people in the music business are very sympathetic to the plights of indie filmmakers. And so they often, sometimes they do try and they just are, you know, they don't care and they'll still screw you over. But we were really fortunate on this movie and we got a lot of great pieces for relatively affordable prices. So we were able to afford it. I mean, it definitely was probably one of our more expensive queues, but not the most expensive queue, interestingly enough.
Right. And then at the premiere, I don't know if you guys remember, we invited both Grace Slick and Mickey Thomas, and Grace couldn't make it, but Mickey showed up, and he had no idea what he was walking into. And he came up to, I was talking to Bill afterwards, he came up to Bill and me with tears in his eyes.
Yeah.
And said, "Oh my, thank you so much for this." He said, "You know, look, I'm on this circuit where sometimes I'm playing really great venues. Sometimes the venues are not as great. You know, I can be on like, you know, playing casinos sometimes. And sometimes it can be hard to really feel invigorated and want to give your best performance. But this was so incredible that now when I get on stage, I can just think of Bill and Kristen and I will always feel energized to want to just bring everything I have to this song." And Bill and I were just like, "Thank you, Mickey. I mean, thank you." It was a really touching moment.
That's amazing. All right. So Milo tells Maggie about a boy that had once bullied him, a boy who their father had assured him would peak in high school and have a miserable adult life. But it turns out the bully had a great life and it's Milo who peaked in high school, which is such great writing. Jerry, can you talk about all the scripts that don't do this? Because I cannot tell you how many generic road trip, dramedy, Sundance-y kind of scripts I've read that just aren't this good. You know, it really just crushes every little beat of this story.
It's just a great script. I mean, it's hard to really contextualize. Craig, I mean, we just had such a great team and it was such a collaborative experience. I mean, I think Jenny is really probably better suited to answer the question around all of this stuff or Steph, but it was like we were just laughing and crying the whole step of the way. It was pretty wonderful.
I think back to your first question, Dan, how we pulled this movie off. When we were emailing this week about it, we're still in shock that we made this movie for as little as we did in New York City, right after a natural disaster, no less. And also like our financing had fallen apart, I think 2 weeks before we were supposed to start or 3 weeks before we started pre-production and we got a new financer. It was like everything that in like the textbooks and the classes about, you know, indie filmmaking, like the pitfalls, they all happened plus more to us. And yet we had such a great group. That was really the reason we got such a great group was because the script was so excellent. I think that people are willing to, you know, work for less and put their whole hearts into it if they see that the potential on the page. And it was, you know, we all read a ton of scripts and so rarely do they move you or make you want to do it even if they're paying you a lot of money. So the fact that we had such a great group really is because the script was excellent from the crew, obviously through the cast. So that's what made it all the easier. And, you know, you look at people who, you know, are friends and now, you know, are now friends and colleagues who worked in the movie who are having great careers. And it was a really just charmed experience.
The problem with a script like this though, because it's so, the nuance is so well interwoven, is that I often will read a script, you know, people send me stuff all the time and be like, "Oh, well, we loved Skeleton Twins." And I'm just like, it's just not as good as the Skeleton Twins. Sorry. I mean, I can't say that. But like, you know, I get what you're going for, but sorry.
You know,
just watch the Skeleton Twins and write yourself into it. Try a different direction.
it's such a weird split. Part of it was based off of like, you know, Mark grew up in Santa Fe and in his community when he was growing up, there was a scandal and there was a student who had an affair with her math teacher. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the part of the genesis of when they first started writing it. And they were both in film school when they started writing it together. And when I first read the script, and this is after they had done many drafts. It was sitting in a drawer somewhere, and they took it out after a few years. We're looking for our next thing to do together. And it was really more Milo's story. It was just really more Milo. There were stories of like Rich with his wife and his two kids, like by themselves. Like, you know, it was very different. But, you know, Maggie was always sort of a supporting player in that. But it was really it became really clear, like, you know, not everybody can relate to the specifics of the Milo Rich dynamic. And that is very fascinating and very specific and very dark, right? But a lot of people have brothers and sisters and understand that connection, even if they weren't actual twins, right? And so it was very clear. I'm like, this structure wise, I'm like, this is a non-romantic love story. Like, you have to be rooting for them. We have to throw a lot of barriers in front of them, and you have to be rooting for them. And still, I watched the movie this morning in preparation for this, and I haven't seen it probably since our cast and crew screening. And I was like, the tears coming down my face, because I have a brother and I'm really close, and you know, Craig has a sister and they're really close, and you know, just the specificity of that, there's something very universal, even though they're a very specific type of brother and sister, but it's very easy to relate to it, and it's very easy to open your heart to it, you know.
Totally. Yeah, I had the same experience.
I think that's right, Jenny. I think the open-heartedness, because I can think of probably 3 or 4 specific incidents where after the movie came out, people came up to me and said things like, I haven't spoken to my sibling in X number of years, and I'm going to call them now.
Aww. Wow. Amazing. Yeah, it's a beautiful movie. I'm going to zip through a bunch of plot here. I actually had some questions in here that you guys have just answered naturally in the course of our conversation. So we're going to kind of zip to the end. But basically, Maggie asks for reassurance that Milo will not kill himself. He promises to try not to. They spend Halloween together. They reminisce about their father's death. Maggie ends up figuring out that Milo's been talking to Rich, which she's very upset with him about. We find out that she is actually the one who exposed their relationship back in high school. Lance and Milo have a dude's day and really get along. And then Lance confides to Milo that he's concerned he might be infertile. And Milo mentions that Maggie used to hide cigarettes around the house to plant the seed for Lance to look for the birth control, which he does. Maggie ends the relationship with Billy the scuba guy. She goes home. Lance is there. He's found the birth control pills. He confronts her about it. She admits the affairs. Then she goes to Milo, basically tells him, hey, you ruined my marriage. Milo says that was no marriage. And then she tells him basically, hey, you should have cut deeper. We talked about how tough that scene was for the actors, which is something I found in research too. Maggie leaves Milo a voicemail echoing his suicide note, which again is such a great, the way she leaves that call. Anybody who knows people who've tried to kill themselves, which I do, and you know, I'm sure you guys may as well. You sometimes get into situations with them where you know they're really down, and they send you a text or they leave you a voicemail, and it's ambiguous. And you sort of are in that horrible position of being like, oh, like, is there something going on? Am I just reading too much into it? And because of their sibling relationship, again, it's a thing of like, only he would know. Only he would know from the voicemail that she left him that she was going to try to kill herself. Nobody else would have known. Everyone else would have thought it was just a normal call and not really read more into it. So what happens is she goes to the pool where she's been taking the scuba lessons, ties weights to her body, jumps in the pool to kill herself. She's starting to drown, changes her mind, tries to escape. She can't because she's weighed herself down. But Milo, having heard the message, jumps in the pool and rescues her. The movie ends with the two of them at her house. They're looking at the new fish tank filled with goldfish. And, you know, I mean, we've sort of talked about this, I think, in general during this conversation. But, you know, when you think about making movies, right, most of the time, the movie, if everything goes great, is going to be sort of good, right? I mean, I think in general, the average movie is maybe okay. Maybe if the casting went really well, it's good. But to make a movie that people will revisit, right? Like, you know, this is a movie that I will probably show my daughter at some point, and I suspect, you know, you guys might show your kids at some point. It's a movie that you can watch this movie 5 years from now, 10 years from now. It'll mean something different to you. It's the same way that I have the same relationship with Sideways, which I watch every like 3 or 4 years. You only get to make, if you're lucky, maybe 3 or 4 movies that are that good in a career. I mean, would that something you guys would agree with? And sort of just what does it mean to you to have gotten to make this movie that, you know, is a powerful movie that means something to people?
I mean, I think it's wonderful. I mean, thank you for saying that. You know, I think, like I was saying earlier, you could tell it was going to be, you know, it had the great potential from the script, and because it attracted so many great people, you know, I feel that a lot of times, if you have a joyful set, even though there was a lot of darkness in this this story, it translates onto the screen. Like, you can feel the emotion and the love and the care and in a project when, you know, I think a lot of why a lot of things turn out great is because it was a great experience and everyone was working their hardest and all of that. So there were such fond memories from the whole thing. So it's really great that it turned out great. I think we all believed that it would. And certainly, you know, every movie but all at the same time, you know, as we were making it, there were moments where we were like dying laughing on set, like, this is gonna be great. And because of the tonal, you know, issues that we found once we were editing that, you know, we were talking about and Jenny was talking about earlier, you know, we're like, how could this scene not possibly work? And, you know, it's what you learn in the process. And so we figured out, you know, a way to get the right tonal balance. And, you know, I'm so proud of it. I think we're all so proud of it. And it is great. I also rewatched it this week for the first time since the premiere. And I actually think it's my only movie I've rewatched because I never have had a reason to. And I cried, I laughed. I mean, it still got me. And I feel like it's, I mean, we made it almost maybe 9 years ago, 8.5, 9 years ago. And I feel like it really has aged well. So I'm really proud of it and so glad I got to be a part of it.
It definitely holds up. I mean, I think there are movies that you can really admire because of technically how they're pulled off. And they can really make you think and be thought-provoking. But this movie, I mean, I think there's great craft and, you know, I think the music is like a huge part of it as well. The Nathan Larson score is like incredible. Like there's so many pieces to it, their chemistry. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is a movie that people can really just feel attached to because they do have sibling relationships, because they understand the highs and lows of the sibling relationships. And so, yeah, it's still that movie that people will pull out of my resume and being like, I remember seeing this and crying so hard and I loved it. And, you know, it's just to make a movie that people genuinely love and that is personally meaningful is incredibly fulfilling. And you're right. You only get to do a couple of, you know, really stellar that are like firing on all cylinders, but to have one that just like really deliver something emotionally and like that makes you just sit there. And I remember we were looking at like the end credit sequence, like we had a wonderful title designer named Christy Hume, and we had some like cute fun designs on it that were like Halloween themed or whatever else, and we're like, oh no, you need a slow curtain and you need to sit there while the tears are rolling down your face because you need to like time to collect yourself after that. And yeah, if you can deliver that at the end of the movie, like they're literally just standing there and like it ends on goldfish and you're just bawling like watching that. And if you can deliver that, you know, you nail the beginning, you nail the middle, you nail the end, but also just really get people to feel and to care, that's like a gift. Like I feel so fortunate to be a part of it, to have been a part of it early on, and yeah, it's always going to be special to me. Yeah,
it really is that old adage, right? Like make them laugh, make them cry, and the movie just does it, and so people feel like they are able to really open up when they watch it, and it just, I don't know. I mean, you could tell by the rapport that we all have. It's like, we just had so much fun making the movie.
Yeah.
And even today, any opportunity I have for anyone, you know, anytime anyone asks me about the movie, I love talking about the experience.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much. That is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. If you dig the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. It's a big help to the show. I want to thank my guests, Jared, Jennifer, and Stephanie. Until next time, bye-bye.